Hi, my name is Mark Wanamaker, and I am a professional historian relating to the motion picture and television industry, and also specialize in the history of Southern California, Los Angeles, Cecil B. DeMille. And while I was at the estate researching the history of his involvement in the creation of Paramount Pictures and other interesting stories about him and his involvement with Los Angeles' history, I was amazed to see that Cecil B. DeMille was a major investor in the Brown Derby enterprise. And he knew Mr. Somborn, who started it, and he knew Mr. Cobb, who continued it. And he was very much involved with its operation. And not only did he own the property of where the building was located, he also owned a piece of the business. So you can imagine in his files, there were interesting documents and things relating to this, which focused in on the, for me, the Brown Derby history. Found out that it opened in 1941, and it was already a restaurant, which I had no idea, because I found some pictures of what it used to be. It used to be called Willard's, and Willard's was a chain of these little restaurants, drive-ins, around town, like roadhouses. And apparently DeMille purchased that property, and they built this brand new streamlined designed restaurant, which they called the car, the Brown Derby Car Cafe. So I got really interested, and that's how DeMille came into that. That's what I found there, besides other interesting documents relating to their merchandising of their liquors and wines under the Brown Derby label. And that they opened a store, actually, somewhere on, I think it's next to the Brown Derby in Hollywood, an actual store, a liquor store, which you could go in there and buy Brown Derby products. So
you could actually buy a bottle of Brown Derby wine.
Yeah, exactly.
Are any of these bottles floating around anyplace?
DeMille had some of them in his wine cellar, which the wine was no good.
You tried it.
No, but you could see that was vinegar, and that I pulled, I dumped some of it out and kept the bottles, a few of the bottles, which is a collectible. And of course, I met Sally Cobb, the wife of Cobb, and who the Cobb salad is named after, of course. And Bob Cobb, I mean, he was the second owner after Mr. Somborn died. And it was really Cobb that made it the most famous in the whole world. And Peggy Cobb Walsh is, the family members and Sally Cobb and all of these surviving people. Well, Sally Cobb passed away not too long ago. But I worked on a book that she did with a writer by Mark Willems, his name is. And it's called The Brown Derby Restaurant, A Hollywood Legend. But basically, the whole book is of what most people are interested in, that is the movie stars that came to all the Brown Derbies and some of the recipes, the famous recipes. Of course, the most famous one is the Cobb salad. But the main thing people are interested in, of course, are the movie stars that made it famous. And there were regulars, everyone from Chaplin to Barrymore to Jerry Lewis to, all the contemporary people up to the 60s. Early 70s, pretty much ended. It was not the same Brown Derby as it used to be. But in its heyday, from the 20s all the way up to the 60s, I mean, everybody in Hollywood at one time or another did go to the Derby. And the Derby's importance relating to someone like me, studio and industry historian, is the simple fact that Brown Derby was used by the film industry for publicity matters, and the Brown Derby people loved it, and they allowed the camera people to come in, do interviews. People did radio programs out of there. They did publicity events, dance events, etc., etc., and that is what made the Brown Derby famous. Film companies actually came and used both Brown Derbies as a film location, the Hollywood one and the Hat, all the way back to the 20s, the silent era. And it became a national and international icon of Hollywood. And on postcards, that were sent all around the world. You could see on there, it said, "Greetings from Hollywood," even though the hat was located on Wilshire Boulevard in the Miracle Mile of Los Angeles. It wasn't Miracle Mile, excuse me. In the Wilshire District of Los Angeles, right across the street from the Ambassador Hotel. But didn't matter, because so many Hollywood people stayed and dealt with their business affairs at the Ambassador Hotel and went to the Round Derby, parts of Los Angeles, like that area there, was known as Hollywood, even though it wasn't physically in Hollywood. But then the idea of Hollywood is Los Angeles anyway. Culver City, where MGM was located for many years, was called Hollywood, until the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce made a deal with the Culver City Chamber of Commerce, in which then the MGM studio would advertise their film as being made from Culver City, not Hollywood anymore.
Okay.
So the Brown Derby in Los Feliz is interesting because in those days, when it opened in 1941, that whole area there was more or less residential as it is today. And there were a few corners here and there which had a commercial district. And Hillhurst and in Los Feliz Boulevard, where it's located, is sort of right on the edge there in between the residential neighborhoods. And Cecil B. DeMille only lived a couple miles away, really, in Laughlin Park, which is part of Los Feliz. So the car cafe became a part of the new car culture coming up right at the beginning of World War II. And, of course, everything was put on hold until after World War II. And then the car culture, as we all know, boomed, starting in 1948 and 49 into the 50s, as being really synonymous with California and convertibles and drive-ins. Skater to carry a heavy tray and roll around with it. I'm telling you, they had to be skilled.
We're speaking with Mark Wanamaker, Hollywood historian. Is the Derby, this last remaining Derby, is it really that significant or that important as a piece of Hollywood history, and is preserving it something that's really essential to preserving Hollywood history?
That's an excellent question, and a lot of people ask me that. What do we care? Well, people like myself, of course, grew up here and went to these places and experienced this lifestyle, etc., which was unique to parts of the United States or being American. And when we lose these historic sites and it's replaced by something nondescript, something that is common or something that is just redundant, you know, like you see everywhere, like a 7-Eleven, for example, I mean, a little bit of the history and culture of the area disappears along with it. And it's important to the tourist industry here that when tourists come here, they're going to come and see something. You know, I mean, why would they even come here at all if there's nothing to see? If they have a 7-Eleven back where they live, and they come here to look at a Hollywood 7-Eleven, what's the difference? They're not going to come here anymore. They might come here just for the weather, maybe, and that's all. And then, of course, for the residents here, whether you're born here or not, when people come here from other countries or states to live in California and live in Los Angeles, they want to live somewhere where there's some culture, some history, something that was here before them that distinguishes the area from anywhere else. And so it's a proven fact that that people need some roots. People need to know where they're, what's happened here, significantly or not. The architecture-wise, of course, we hardly have any drive-ins anymore. And even though it's not a drive-in now, it still is one of the few buildings left around town, which kind of harkens back to the car culture of what Los Angeles, Southern California was all about. So yes, it's important that we try to keep as many of these sites as possible. I'm talking theaters, public buildings, restaurants, historical and cultural sites, etc. And without this, I mean, we really have a very empty cultural life. We'll be right back.
All you girls should pay some mind. When you find a man worth keeping, be satisfied, huh? Make sure to treat him kind, 'cause a good man is hard to find. You can always get the other kind. When you think you got a pal, you can find him messing around another gal, then you rave.
The specific situation.
You start to crave to see him land deep down on his grave.
Where so the derby is sitting on a lawn and a developer wants to build some condominiums.
You better hug him in the morning, kiss him every night, give him plenty loving, treat him
that
right.
Lawn. Because
a good man.
Now is there some way that the derby could either be integrated into their design, do you think, or is it possible that the derby could be moved to another location?
One fine day, she met some other cat. He took all the money, then left the flat.
He's a dirty rover!
Now she's calling me on the phone. She said, baby, you better come on home all alone. But if I'm gonna go back to her grand shack, she's gotta hug me in the morning, kiss me every night, give me plenty loving, treat me right. I cause a good man nowadays is hard to find.
That's a really good question. I mean, there's three questions here and three answers to that. The first answer to the first question, basically about the housing situation, there are many, many, many lots and places to develop other than historic sites. Number one.
But not stubble alive. And now she knows what to do. When the day is through, she's gotta hug me in the AM, kiss me in the PM, give me plenty loving with all her might. I cause a good man nowadays is hard to find.
Why they glom onto historic sites to develop and leave other places left open is beyond my interest. I mean, I don't understand. Number two, if it is a done deal, yes, there have been many occasions in which the historic place was incorporated into the project. We're working on many like that in Hollywood right now, in which we incorporated the original building and they built a mall or something around it and used it inside and used it as a publicity tool, by the way, to advertise the new development as a historic site, you know, this kind of thing. Distances within the city, so to move it somewhere else is just it would not if not work. In other words, the impact of its historical importance and everything would be lost. It can be a Louisa's or anything. I don't care. It's just that it would be nice to have it back to its original form and function as a restaurant or a club or whatever they want. I don't care. It's just that I would like to see it in my fantasy, you know, put back to what it looked like and put that Brown Derby sign back on top. Saying this is the Brown Derby historic site. A wonderful collectible, which I have one for myself and one for Hollywood Heritage, and that is a miniature little hat box with a little miniature felt derby in it with beautiful pictures and everything of all the derbies on it. And this was produced, this little souvenir hat was produced in the late 20s and into the 30s as a collectible for people to buy. And not only did they have these little hats, they had ashtrays and key rings and cigarette cases and candy boxes and all kinds of merchandising was done for the Brown Derby over its long history. And we're always looking for these wonderful, whimsical items that have come out over the years. They are highly prized by us. And yes, we do put them on exhibition at the Hollywood Studio. It's called the Hollywood Heritage Museum, or the Lasky DeMille Barn. It's a museum of old Hollywood and filmmaking in Hollywood, which is located across from the Hollywood Bowl on Highland Avenue in Hollywood. To the early 20s on that same site. And it should be a landmark because it's a cultural landmark. It was a important, Willard's was very famous and important in its day. And then, of course, the Brown Derby being there, drive-in, was important in its day.
There are other topics that are sort of most famous or most well-known, the Cobb salad, for example. As a historian, have you found, or in your researches, have you found or learned about some sort of neglected pieces of history that really don't get talked about much?
Well, pretty much relating to the Brown Derby, which is kind of being lost, is that the Hollywood Brown Derby and the Beverly Hills Brown Derby started a tradition of having certain artists come in and do caricatures of the famous movie stars that came and ate at the Brown Derby. Matter of fact, it became a signature icon of the Brown Derby, the famous drawings that were of these portraits of all the famous people. In the Hollywood Brown Derby in the 1950s, there had been at least 200 or 300 of these original artworks hanging on display in the main room of the Brown Derby. And one of the artists that did this work, his name was Vitch, V-I-T-C-H. And this guy, I mean, he was an incredible caricaturist, and he was hired by Bob Cobb to come in and just sketch different people that came in there. We're talking in the starting around 1933. And agents even tried to have their clients' images placed alongside those of the Hollywood great. So if you have John Barrymore, a younger star that was sketched, and the agents were now vying to make sure that that sketch was next to Barrymore's or something. So this became a whole inner cultural event that was going on at the Brown Derby. We have a website, so just go to Hollywood Heritage and it'll come up.
Specific questions they'd like to follow up with you, is there some way they could reach you by?
Right through the Hollywood Heritage website, there's ways to contact us and ask questions or to offer something or become a member or whatever.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Mark. It was great talking to you, and wonderful hearing these stories about old Hollywood.
Well, thank you, too.
You are Mike Adler.
I'm one of the owners.
You are Mike Adler.
Mike Adler. And my company is Adler Realty Investments, Inc. And we're a small real estate investment company. We have probably maybe 20 projects right now, mostly in California. We have some in other states. And this is, we acquired this property, it's currently leased, and we're happy with the tenants that we have, and we'll continue leasing to these tenants until they're not there anymore, their leases are up, and it's time for them to move on. So this whole project that we're working on as far as the redevelopment, it's probably not going to happen for a while, and that's what's kind of interesting to me, why it's getting so much attention right now when this is something that, could happen down the road sometime.
Right. I understand the lease of the current tenants is several years out. Is that correct?
Correct. Plus, I believe they have options. It could be 7 years.
7 years. Okay. I wanted to ask you if there were certain complaints or criticisms of the project that you feel are misguided or based on a misunderstanding.
Well, everyone is entitled to their own opinions, and I understand that there are some people that have various reasons for why nothing should be done on the site. So it's hard for me to comment on what other people think. If you ask 10 different people, you'll have 10 different answers. One thing that we got from the various meetings, some people want to see a Whole Foods market there, other people adamantly don't. Some people want to see residential there, some people don't. Some people want to see it exactly the way it is right now with nothing. So we just, we're hearing a lot of different opinions of what to do. Even after our last meeting, where we had a lot of people voicing very negative concerns, we also had people that were voicing some positive input as well. And what's interesting is that the positive opinions seem to be much less vocal than the negative.
Okay. Maybe you could share some of the positives that you think people might have not heard.
There was a letter that was just written by someone. Let me see if I can find this. We're constantly getting mail on this.
Okay. Just wanted to mention to our listeners, again, we're listening to Michael Adler of Adler Realty. They are... is Adler Realty the sole owner of the property?
We are a partner. Along with two men, Duncan Lemon and John Battle.
Okay.
They were the they're part of Lee and Associates, which is a commercial real estate company.
Okay.
And I cannot find the letter. Can I put you on hold for a second?
Oh yeah, definitely.
One misconception is that we're further along than we are. I think we've been having these neighborhood meetings so that we can get an idea of what, what the neighbors are looking for, what they like, what they don't like. And, I know there's some groups that would love to see nothing at all happen. And I understand why that might be. Some people just don't like change. But it's telling us, no, you can't do anything on this site. It's similar to telling a homeowner, no, you can't, you can't add on to your house, or you can't, remodel your house. And it's, it's not something that that is a viable option. One misconception is the zoning issue, where what we're asking to do is to revise the zoning to an RAS3 or RAS4 type zone. Right now there's a multiple of zonings on the property, and we can build a similar type of development with the way it is, but each building would have to be separate. In other words, we'd have a retail building or a commercial building on the commercial portion. We'd have apartment buildings on the apartment or on the residential portion, and it would be a mishmash of a bunch of different types of uses, which, you know, in the long run is a disadvantage to the community. It'll actually look worse than if we could combine and, you know, make everything more, you know, conforming into one, you know, project rather than just a bunch of different projects.
Hello, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to killradio.org. Today's show is called The Brown Derby. And we're listening to interviews of a variety of people regarding some proposed condominiums to be developed at the corner of Los Feliz Boulevard and Hillhurst. We're speaking to some folks about housing issues, legal issues, political issues, economic issues, aesthetic issues, and we're going to be continuing to listen to a whole lot of swing music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Johnny Radio. That's council member Tom Labonge.
Los Feliz Improvement Association was copied, and Franklin Hills Residents Association, they were also copied. So
okay.
I think there's letters floating around, but it says, and I don't know this person. My wife and I have been part of the Los Feliz area for over 20 years. As you may recall, we have both served various Southern California communities as city attorney. Never have we seen a more phony issue than the attempt to stall residential development because the above location is allegedly inhibited by a historical significant structure. Neither of us are pro-development. However, we are for good projects that makes sense. Supplementing a bar restaurant with a well-planned residential development makes sense. Certainly, consider consideration should be given to improve issues such as traffic flow, parking, and aesthetics. No consideration should be given for the shame issue of historic preservation for a bar with a chain restaurant attached. Formerly, it was another restaurant called Michael's. In the real world, the existing site deserves no special consideration. In terms of legality, stoppage of this project on a conservation ground will never stand up. The so-called Derby has no recognition to those passing by. It is not a notable structure in its appearance or design, and has not necessarily been a good neighbor.
Some way that your project might accommodate preserving it, or have you thought about that?
Well, as I said in our last meeting, we are looking into ways of preserving either all of it or part of it as part of our plan.
Okay.
This is something that had come up pretty far into our overall designing, and we're now trying to work with that to see if there's a way we can accommodate.
Oh, okay. So it's an issue that you were not made aware of previously.
It was an issue we weren't made aware of until the Save the Derby group became vocal, which was probably several months into our designing phase.
Okay, which began when? Approximately.
Design phase was earlier this year.
Okay.
Ever been involved in an architectural review hearing, you can show a design to 10 different people. people and you'll get 10 different criticisms. And what we're trying to do is listen to everyone and then with that information make whatever changes are needed to to appease as many people as possible. And we already have made several different changes to the exterior, to the architecture from our original projects, and I think you've seen a couple of previous iterations in the past, and they're constantly being changed. We'll probably make another change after this series of meetings, the one last week, and then the other meeting that's coming up.
That neighborhood, like plenty of neighborhoods in LA, is characterized by great diversity in the architecture. Different houses were designed and built at different times, designed by different people, and it creates the tremendous diversity and richness in the overall look of the area. Project would create a kind of uniformity.
It's one property among a whole neighborhood, and it's going to be different than everything else in the neighborhood, so I don't see how it would create a uniformity.
Uniformity just within itself, I guess, and since it is so large and takes up.
It's not that large. This is, if we're building 80 units, which is what we're proposing, that's not larger than many of the other projects right within the 500-foot radius.
Okay.
In fact, all of the other apartment complexes that are within that area are larger than this one.
Okay.
And I think that might be a misconception that we're building this monster project. This project is not very large from a number of units or a square footage standpoint compared to what's around it.
The issue of housing. John Battle mentioned to me that, and I don't mean to misquote him, but that creating new housing in Los Angeles would help sort of relieve the housing shortage. Do you think that's correct?
Of course, yes.
I'm curious to know what...
And another thing that may be contrary to what most people think is that I think it also, in the overall macro scope, relieves traffic congestion. because you have less people that are forced to live further out and who have to drive on more surface streets in order to get to wherever they're going.
There might be people that are living in lower rent, lower cost
rentals in the area that may be able to afford to live somewhere nicer, but it's not available. And by making it available, they move out of those lower rent properties into the newer property, and then thus freeing up vacancy in the lower rent properties for other people to move into.
Keep that in mind for future reference.
Okay. I wanted to ask a little bit about the issue of the area in general, Echo Park, Silver Lake, Los Feliz. It's a diverse community. Economically as well as ethnically diverse, culturally diverse. Los Feliz and Echo Park are very different from each other in terms of sort of demographically.
Right.
And I'm not so, you know, I'm not sure that a higher rent condo is inconsistent with the income levels or the rentals in Los Feliz. Would you say that's correct?
Well, the rents may not be very different from other projects in Los Feliz.
There are a lot of private homes in Los Feliz. And this is just a very general question, which hopefully you can help me understand on a more specific level.
Corner location where that's not conducive adding additional units does add traffic, and it's something that we need to and have looked into as far as mitigation and how do we develop this so that it has the least amount of impact on traffic.
Sets in Los Feliz, and we're discussing proposed development that Adler Realty wants to build 80 unit condos on the corner of what is the intersection?
The corner of Hillhurst and Los Feliz Boulevard. Los
Feliz. Okay, the development is actually halfway down the block, isn't it?
It starts. On Los Feliz, and it goes down Hillhurst the entire way down the block.
Okay.
I think I understand where everyone's coming from, and I know that a lot of people don't like to see change, but I think that our project, when it gets finished and we finish our designs, I think everyone will like it. And storefront along Hillhurst on the other side of the street and further down on our side of the street. And we'd like to continue that on, you know, on this particular site. Right now it's not set up where it's pedestrian friendly. The way the Derby is set up, you're walking up a steep flight of steps to get up to the level where what we want to accomplish is to have ground floor retail shops along Hillhurst so people can walk in.
Jiggers of moonlight and add a star, pour in the blue of a June night and one guitar.
Mix in a couple of dreamers and there you are. Lovers hail the moonlight cocktail.
Now add a couple of flowers, a drop of dew. Stir for a couple of hours till dreams come true.
As to the number of kisses, it's up to you.
Moonlight cocktails need a few. Cool it in the summer breeze. Serve it in the starlight underneath the trees.
You discover tricks like these are sure to make your moonlight cocktails please.
Follow the simple directions and they will bring life of another complexion where you'll be king.
You will awake in the morning and start to sing.
Moonlight cocktails are the thing.
And I understand also that there's a parking issue along Hillhurst because there's just not enough parking. And one of the things we do plan is to add a lot of additional off-site parking so that people that are going to not only to our project but also to some of the other stores, they'll have off-site areas to park as well. Yes. Well, it
will bring life of another complexion where you'll be king.
You will awake in the morning and start to sing.
Moonlight cocktails are the thing.
You've been listening. Hello. You've been listening to the Brown Derby on killradio.org. We're enjoying a number of wonderful artists from yesteryear. Folks like Benny Goodman, Duke Ellington, Stan Kenton, Harry James, Glenn Gray, Les Brown, Billy May, Woody Herman, and more. This is the Brown Derby. Thank you.
your back on your heels. Goody, goody, so you met someone and now you know how it feels. Goody, goody, so you gave her your heart too, just as I gave mine to you. And she broke it in little pieces. Now how do you do? So you lie awake just singing the blues all night. Goody, goody, so you think that love's a barrel of dynamite. Hooray and hallelujah, you had it coming to ya. Goody, goody for her, goody, goody for me. And I hope you're satisfied, you rascal, you.
Garage, in the sense that the parking will be below grade and at grade behind the retail.
Michael Albert, we appreciate your time today. It was a pleasure chatting with you, and you've shared some enlightening insights about your project.
Thank you.
I'm the Association of Nonprofit Housing and Housing LA. We're a regional membership organization of folks who build and manage and preserve affordable housing for very low-income people.
What do you guys not do, or how are you different from other organizations you might be confused with?
Well, there's no other organization that does exactly what we do, so not to confuse us.
An explanation of that would be very helpful.
Mostly the tenant groups organize around slum housing. And then there are organizations that work with private developers that build market rate housing. What we work with are actual builders, community development corporations, or CDCs, that are nonprofit organizations that are mission-oriented and work in sometimes specific neighborhoods or sometimes in more than one neighborhood, and they build, often they build more than housing, but specifically they build housing for low-income people. It's not placed on the market. It's housing that only serves low-income people. They often do things like build child care centers and after-school programs that they provide in their projects, community centers. Some of our members have built health clinics, things like that. They really are community builders in the best sense of the word.
Jan, you know that we're talking about this new development coming up in Los Feliz, which is not at all low-income housing. In fact, it's probably going to be upper-income housing, or I should say...
Who's the developer?
The developer's, well, the part of one of the owners is Adler Realty. And another group is called Lee and Associates. And there's one other, I'm sorry, I don't have the name.
Here's the situation in Los Angeles. And if you're just talking about the city, sometimes the stats are by the city and sometimes the statistics are by county. The city of Los Angeles is over 60% renters. We're like 61% renters. Most people rent in Los Angeles because they can't afford to buy. And the majority of that 61 or 60 whatever it is percent of people who rent are never going to buy a house, and they can't even afford the high rent. Los Angeles has a fairly low median income. Orange County has a median income of almost $80,000 a year. Ventura has a median income of almost $80,000 a year. Los Angeles County's median income for a family of four is in the low 50s. So you can see that Los Angeles, we have high costs and low incomes, and comparatively low incomes. And the reason our median income is so low is because we have such a large, very low-income population. We have a large service population. We have a large population of people who are doing work with, for which they are getting paid $6, $8, $10 an hour, less than $25,000 a year with no benefits. Those people cannot afford to pay $3,000 a month in rent.
Right.
Nor can they afford to buy a home.
Right. But some people can. Does it take housing away from lower-income people, or does
no.
it does it somehow increase the housing crunch for lower-income people?
It doesn't take housing away. Well, increasing upper-end housing simply gives people who have upper-end incomes more housing choice. It depends on what you mean by upper end. I mean, if the project you're talking about is going to be a rental project that's high end, you're going to be talking about rental units that are going to go from $2,500 to $4,000 a month. Now, where those people who can afford that are presently living, when they move out from where they're presently living, and maybe they're already paying $3,000 a month and they're just going to move to a nicer place, they are not necessarily living in a two-bedroom apartment that costs $800 a month.
So
they're not going to free it up. If they move wherever they're moving, it's where they're moving from is not going to be freed for a low-income person because where a low-income person can't afford where they're living already.
Right.
If you follow that.
Partially, and I'm going to cover two parts of that. The first part is sort of a response to the assertion that by creating these condos, that there are folks who currently can afford to live in those condos, but since those condos don't exist, those same folks are taking up lower-priced housing and thus preventing lower-income people from living in that lower-priced housing.
Oh,
There's no evidence that those people are living in such lower-priced housing. They might be living in comparably priced housing, and even if it's slightly lower than what they'll be able to afford to move into the condo, it's where they're living now is too expensive for low-income people to move into. So the fact that Family A, the Smith family, is living in an apartment where they are paying $2,700 a month for rent. This condo gets built, and they move over because they decide they can actually afford $3,500 a month for the mortgage and the taxes and whatever, $3,800 a month. So they move from their $2,700 a month apartment. Well, the majority of people in Los Angeles cannot afford $2,700. The only people who are going to move into the apartment that Family Smith is leaving behind is somebody else who's earning the same kind of income. Not growing by leaps and bounds, although they are growing faster than the middle class. The only income sector that's growing faster is the low-income sector. Low-income jobs, most jobs that are being produced in Los Angeles County in the last period of time, according to the Los Angeles Economic Development Corporation, are paying less than $25,000 a year. Pent-up market for housing for people who can only afford to pay. If you're earning $25,000 a year, according to the federal government, you cannot be paying more than about $800 a month.
Thank you.
it's not tomorrow going to move into a $3,500.
No, it falls apart. It's an old-fashioned argument, and it has been debunked in the Los Angeles real estate market for about 15 years. At one point in time, it was not incorrect. It has long since been incorrect.
Oh, okay, so it was correct at one point.
You know, people argue that it was, yeah, but, you know, that if you have enough housing stock at all income levels, then the movement throughout that stock, in fact, creates, you know, if you have enough stock for the entry level low income household, and then you have enough stock for the middle income household, and you have enough stock for households that may increase their incomes as they grow older or whatever. If you have enough stock for all income levels, then movement around them can in fact do that. But we don't have enough stock for any income level.
Radio.org. Jan, can you please pronounce your last name?
Breidenbach.
We're speaking to Jan Breidenbach. The name of your organization again?
Southern California Association of Nonprofit Housing.
And your website?
www.scamph.org.
Can you spell that, please?
scamph.org.
Okay. Question. Is there anything that your organization or anyone is suggesting whereby developers of expensive housing do something as part of their plan to help the community or to create housing opportunities?
A lot of local jurisdictions have what they call inclusionary housing. A much smaller city and was a growing city, and a lot of the housing stock that was apartments, that was rental housing, was built for very small households, individuals before they formed families, possibly older people, and we were building homes, moving out and out and out. Then you have what we call housing choice. We don't build anything much, I mean, we don't build low-end anymore in terms of income, and we don't have enough housing. When you don't have enough housing, you don't have housing choice. And if you don't have housing choice, then somebody moving from one fairly expensive apartment to a more expensive condo doesn't free up anybody to somebody who can't afford it in the first place.
Right. Not be thrilled with that idea. People might feel uncomfortable with the idea of mixing different income levels in the same neighborhoods. Is there any legitimacy to those concerns?
You know, I don't. We mix incomes in neighborhoods all the time, and only we just bring them in to, you know, clean our floors, take care of our children, and park our cars. We don't always want lower-income people living with upper-income people, but we mix incomes all day long.
Child in wild anticipation, long to hear that all aboard. Seven, that's the time we leave at seven. I'll be waiting up for decide to roam. Gotta take that sentimental journey, sentimental journey home, sentimental journey.
Very much, Jen. I hope you have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you.
Hello, listeners. We're not switching to hip-hop now. That was just a brief moment of Bennett. Now we're back to the normal John Radio Show.
And I'm a professor of urban planning in the Department of Urban Planning at UCLA School of Public Affairs.
Local residents also have concerns about the aesthetics of it. Some have said that they don't want some sort of Orange County cookie-cutter condominium in a place which is characterized by diversity of architectural styles.
Right.
And the developer's position is that the Derby is not an official historical landmark, which is correct, and that there's really nothing spectacular or special about the building, and that by putting in some new housing in LA, that will help to relieve the housing shortage.
Not if it's market-rate housing. I mean, well, yes, it helps relieve the shortage, but not for the people who are most in need of housing.
Well, their position, which apparently is an argument that has been floating around for some years, is that people who are going to live in his condos are currently living in less expensive housing, and when they move, they'll free up that less expensive housing.
Right, that's called filtering. It's an old theory in housing literature, and it's basically erroneous, and there is a classic piece of literature, scholarship about it by someone named Matt Edel, E-D-E-L, who has since passed away, but who basically pointed out that the premise of filtering is that there's an even playing field and that people who are poor will move up, you know, the ladder into the housing that's one step above them, but it doesn't take into consideration either racial segregation or economic segregation. And we're currently in a situation where vast majority of low-income people who are earning below the poverty level will never make it into those houses that are one step above them.
Okay. When you say racial segregation, are you suggesting that the management of these condos?
mean, there are areas, I mean, race and income are heavily correlated. And so the likelihood of someone who is low income moving into an area, where is not likely to have the income to move into that house that has been vacated by...
In other words,
figures, but as of a few years ago, I mean, you needed to earn at least $20 an hour in order to afford an apartment. not going to affect the, it's not going to have a positive effect on low-income people.
Okay. Is there something that, that this developer could or in other words, yes.
Able to afford housing at the median income or at the median price of an opening. And $20 relationship with the, through at the bottom minimum wage. Structural problem gap changing column is that people think that it's think now. Fighting higher end, lower end of the market.
Okay. Developments. Name.
Lower end of the market. Higher end of fighting. But think that it gives the people now not a part of the housing. There's a high, a whole. Many times in. Killradio.org?
That's correct.
It's a great name. Okay. Bye, Johnny Radio.
Thank you, Dr. Levin.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Traffic elsewhere, and it to a greater degree than it increases traffic at the local intersection. So it's a matter of what geographic scale you're looking at the issue. So it can do both those things the same. By making traffic a little worse here, we've reduced it elsewhere. Yeah, the way to think about it is that you can have debates about Los Angeles is already a very large and very crowded metropolitan area, and there's lots of pressure for it to continue growing. How to accommodate that growth is a normative question. What are the best ways to cope with that? One easy way to do it is to add additional development on the fringe, making the exurb suburbs, because the first development to go out there is likely to be housing. You end up, on average, generating fairly long trips of people who are then driving back into the city.
Right.
Okay, when you do that, you may not have congestion in the suburbs, but by the time people return to the city, almost always in automobiles, you can add significantly to overall levels of traffic congestion. The flip side is that it can significantly increase localized levels of traffic congestion, even if a larger share of those people are walking, biking, or using public transit. So that's why we tend to see in the central city areas, even in places where people walk, bike, and use transit a lot, like in New York, the streets are still very congested. Off-ramp at 101 in Franklin, you might say, boy, a few more projects like this and we'll see less pressure from people getting on and off the freeway here at this time, then you might think that's positive. If you're living adjacent to the project, you might think it's negative.
That a new condo would, if anything, increase congestion in that area?
It's likely that any project anywhere in any congested area is going to increase congestion.
In that area?
People who are already there, provided they're employed, are likely to oppose that project on the grounds that the quality of life in the area will be worse off.
Right.
Right. So one of the things that we know when we look back at the sort of history of traffic congestion in L.A. is that severe economic downturns are really great for traffic.
Okay.
People who move out, fewer people commute. And that's an example of why, of the tipping point in action. You say, well, you know, employment only dropped 9%. Why did the congestion delay go down 34%? Well, it's because you're right at that margin of capacity. You see, it works in both directions.
The tipping point.
Right. But it really wasn't. It wasn't that. It was that that there had been this economic downturn, which took some pressure off of the road system at the peak periods when most people are traveling to and from work.
Right.
So this is, in general, a dilemma. As I said, this is a much bigger project than this condo project in Hollywood. Is that you're looking at proposals to add the population of the state of Texas to California over the next 20 years. Popular, new freeways aren't popular. rail lines are popular, but they're so expensive that it's tough to do much with that. So that there isn't much effort on that front to add a lot, and then you find yourself sort of in a crisis and response mode. It's exactly analogous to what's going on in the Elliott Unified School District, right? Things crowding has gotten so severe, now spending a lot of money trying to increase capacity. And it may well be the case that happens with the road system over the next few years as well.
Welcome to Kill Radio. Welcome to the Brown Derby. Welcome to Hollywood. Welcome to Los Angeles.
This is the fundamental dilemma: is that if I live in in Los Feliz, I'm going to say, well, let's put that development out in Canyon Country, or let's have it go out in Fontana. And of course, if you live in those areas, you may see things very differently. The problem we have is that the most economically and socially vibrant cities are also the most congested. You don't hear people say, let's move to New York or San Francisco, Paris or London, because their roads are so free. So there's a lot of positive activity that goes along, and it brings about an incumbent or parallel problem of congestion, which is indeed vexing and environmentally wasteful.
Thank you.
But when we look at places that don't have congestion problems, there are almost always places that are suffering socially and economically.
Right.
So, you know, I've compared this in general to looking at problems of malnutrition or obesity, is that those are both serious problems in the world. But if you're a mayor or a governor and you say, would you prefer to be coping in your jurisdiction with the problem of malnutrition or the problem of obesity, the answer's pretty clear.
Right. Can you just mention any situations, any places which are both economically very developed but do not have traffic congestion problems, and how do they do it?
No. I did see a rendering of the proposed project in the Los Angeles Business Journal, and I guess my concern is that it doesn't seem to, doesn't resonate, or doesn't create a type of innovative architecture that Los Angeles was originally known for. You know, we've had different architectural styles that have come up over the years, and the rendering I saw just looks sort of like a standard Mediterranean type building, you know.
Ryan, can I ask you to
But now when you turn the lamp down low, I'm beginning to see the light. Used to ramble through the park, shadow boxing in the dark. Then you came a spark, that's a four-alarm fire now. I never made love by lantern shine. I never saw rainbows in my wine. But now that your lips are burning mine, I'm beginning to see the light.
Tell us what.
Well, as public policy around smart growth issues.
Around which issues?
Issues around smart growth.
Before I continue, I just want to mention that.
Thank you. Okay. Well, we're developing 58 condominiums at a mix of income levels in the city of Long Beach, and it's a block from a Blue Line station. And they're arranged around courtyards so that the residents will be able to have a landscaped, you know, natural area right outside their door. They can watch their children play there and have a place to sort of enjoy semi-private space, but it's also semi-public, so it gives them a chance for interaction.
Make sure to treat them kind, cause the good man is hard to find. You can always get the other kind. When you think you got a pal, you can find him messing around. Another gal, then you rave. You'll even start to crave to see him laying deep down on his grave. So if your man is nice, baby, take my advice. You better hug him in the morning, kiss him every night, give him plenty loving, treat him right, cause the good man nowadays is hard to find. I got a chick, about 6'2". That's a big one. She never thought a midget like me would do. One fine day, she met some other cat. He took all the money, then left the flat.
He's a dirty robber!
No. Now she's calling me on the phone. She said, baby, you better come on home all alone. But if I'm gonna go back to her grand shack, she's gotta hug me in the morning, kiss me every night, give me plenty loving, treat me right, cause the good man nowadays is hard to find. Now we're back. Yeah, but I told that gal and how. I said, then was then, woman, now is now. That's what I said. You want me to stay? There's just one but. Get a smile on your face and keep your big mouth shut. Yeah! Now we're back together, but it's fine. What a house, Jack. She better not stumble a line. And now she knows what to do when the day is through. She's gotta hug me in the AM, kiss me in the PM, give me plenty loving with all her might, cause the good man nowadays is hard to find.
With their neighbors.
You are listening to killradio.org, and we've been listening to all sorts of fascinating people talking, and I enjoy listening to people talking. Let's listen some more.
And it's designed in a sensitive way that steps down to acknowledge the lower density neighborhood that's adjacent. It's a more urban four-story building along Long Beach Boulevard, to create an interesting street edge so that, you know, for pedestrians that are walking, to have something interesting to look at.
This person, Ryan Lehman, from, I'll tell you in a moment where he's from. He's discussing a project that his organization did. It's a special type of housing project, mixed income levels, and sort of innovative approach. His name is Ryan Lehman, the director of Livable Places. That's livableplaces.org. Let's listen to some more.
And to encourage people to walk to the Blue Line transit station.
What are the interesting things that people are going to be looking at?
Well, the buildings have sort of separate entrance courtyards.
Ryan Lehman is describing a project that his organization is working on to create a more human, greener, and more artistic social environment in this project that his organization, Livable Places, has created.
Well, the buildings have sort of separate entrance courtyards. yards with several the homes that front onto each of these courtyards. And so you'll, you know, people will be able to see the front windows of the residents. So if the people are doing some type of, if it's an artist, they might see some hints of artwork through the window. They might just see people sitting out on their balcony or stuff like that.
Well, how is this development different from any other development?
Well, typically the multifamily housing in LA tends to be more arranged around internal hallways and have sort of superficial small balconies around the edge, but doesn't really provide a pleasant sort of indoor-outdoor experience. And often it doesn't have individual entrances off the street, so it's basically everybody's sort of forced to one main entrance.
Traffic you have.
want to provide alternatives to people. And if every new condominium has two parking spaces, then that's about $50,000 of cost you're building in.
the mix of uses. I think they're proposing like a Whole Foods market and condominiums. I think that that mix would actually could potentially reduce traffic if the people that live in the community no longer have to drive to Glendale to Whole Foods. They can just walk or, you know, drive a much shorter distance.
I got a house and drinking everything for my old bubble, my G. You are my inspiration, days that's never blue. After all said and done, baby, you're the only one.
Wouldn't people driving a shorter distance cause greater congestion right there? And won't people leaving in the morning and coming home in the evening cause congestion right there? Extra congestion that otherwise would not have been there, in addition to all the people driving and parking in the supermarket, which I wish we would get anyways because I would like a Whole Foods around here.